down to business.
The Linux Night Tech Show is on. Your link to GNU Linux and the latest technology. 2 hours of insightful guests, tech info, and playful banter.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Free software, free speech, open technology,
and open mic.
I love it.
Now, live from the Linux Link Tech Show studios, here are your hosts, Dan, Alan, Pat, and Link. Link it up and take it away.
Hello. Another exciting episode of the Linux Link Tech Show. Today is December 12, 2007. This is episode 223. Welcome, everybody.
Welcome.
Hey.
The Linkster's back in the house.
Yo.
Send your hate mail now.
Yo, yeah.
Link said, yo, he's a dick.
Time for the hate mail. Oh, see, you have that dick back on the show. What the hell's wrong with you people?
They didn't come here to hear Link. They came here to hear our wonderful guest.
Yes, we got a wonderful guest tonight. We got Aaron Griffin, who is the new big man in charge of the Arch Linux project. Welcome, Aaron.
Thank you very much. How's it going?
Pretty good. Yourself?
I'm doing all right.
So could you give us a little background on what have you been doing with the Arch project before you came the man in charge of, the, I guess, the, what's your title, project lead?
I guess so. I don't really know if there's an official title. I think people have kind of adopted Overlord at some point.
Evil Overlord.
Yeah, a little bit.
So you took over. You took over from Judd Vinay.
That's correct.
And why did he step down?
I think it's more personal reasons, really. Like, you know, he just had not enough time to devote to Arch, whereas I did.
So have you been using Arch since the beginning?
Oh, not the beginning. For a long time though. I think I began using Arch in. Oh, I want to say 2003, 2004.
So why don't you give us a little history of yourself and how you got involved with the Arch project?
That's a little difficult. I got involved with Arch probably the same way most people do, where, you know, they do the whole distro hop thing and spend some time with a bunch of different distros. Nothing really fits that well and nothing really catches by, and then, you know, you hit Arch and kind of realize, you know, hey, this is what I'm looking for. And that happened to me way back when, and, you know, I used Arch passively for a while, just kind of like on my machine sitting there. And at some point I started, you know, just contributing back, you know, with all the stuff I was using, trying to give back, you know, what I could, and I think it all kind of snowballed from there.
Now, Arch was wasn't Arch derived from the principles of Slackware? Was that it?
No, Arch was actually derived more or less from Crux in the beginning.
Wasn't Crux derived from, like, Slackware?
It may have been. I don't really know the everything about Crux exactly.
Okay. But I've been using Arch now for, God, what's it been, 3 years? Has it been 3 years, Pat? You don't know.
No, I think Pat said he had to step away before the baby was crying.
Oh, yeah, now I see it. Link, I've been using Arch for 3 years now, right? Has it been 3 years?
Yeah, I think so.
And all of us, I believe. Alan, have you tried Arch?
No, I
haven't
tried
it. Who hasn't. All of us have.
Alan's a bitch, isn't he? It took us forever to get him to try Slackware, remember?
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Anyway,
then I
all
became
of us
a huge advocate of it, though.
Alan have tried Arch, and we have found it had its pros and cons, but I have really enjoyed Arch for a good 3 years now, and it still remains on my system. One of the problems that I would say that I've had with Arch, which isn't too bad, is when I update, if a new kernel comes down and I forget to run my boot manager, my Lilo, ooh, yeah, we're in trouble. because there was a while there you guys were going from init RD to init RMS or whatever it was, and so many different RAM disks and all sorts of stuff to load in there.
Yeah, well, personally, I mean, part of that, I personally try to recommend Grub as much as possible simply because that right there is, in my opinion, more or less a deficiency of Lilo, however you want to pronounce that, that it needs to be run, you know, with changes of that magnitude. But as far as, you know, problems updating and things like that, it is a little common, and it's almost expected because, see, we have a choice when it comes to a lot of this stuff. We could either, you know, spend an extra couple of weeks or whatever automating things and making sure we're able to do this upgrade cleanly and smoothly without any user interaction. Or we could do something today and simply, you know, make sure to inform the end user that, hey, you need to do something. And as much as possible, we try to go with the latter, the non-automated process. So as far as you know, kernel updates and things like that go, we assume that the user upgrading the system will do the management tasks of, you know, running Lilo again or something like that.
Right, and Arch, the point of Arch is you're supposed to have a little more hands-on, if I'm not mistaken, correct?
That's correct.
It goes with that you are in the Control-C philosophy.
Yes.
So what does do your duties for Arch entail you to do? Are you just herding cats, or what do you do?
Well, that's a kind of tough to answer. For a while there, I was leading up the charge, I guess, on Pac-Man development, our package manager. Because of, you know, these recent things, the whole Overlord thing or whatever, that's taken, I don't want to say backseat, but it's kind of, you know, I've had to step back a little due to time and things like that. So Dan McGee is actually pretty much leading that side up. But I still do some of that, and there's, you know, quite a lot of coding duties and things like that. And yes, there is herding cats involved, but it's a little bit of everything, I guess.
So with, are you in Canada? Also?
No, I'm in Chicago.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Now, do you guys, is it all, do you primarily work online, virtually, or do you guys ever have any meetings that you get together with the core operators of the system?
We never really have any official meetings. Back in, I want to say, 2005, I actually went over to LinuxTag in Germany and met, you know, a large portion of the guys. We have two developers that live here in Chicago or around Chicago, quite a few over in Germany that have met up for things like FrostCon and things like that. So I don't think we've ever had 100% of the developers all in one room meeting together, but we've all met each other at some point for the most part.
Now, is Arch strictly, you know, community supported, funded, or do you guys have any like businesses that have adopted Arch?
We're primarily community supported as far as most things go. We don't really, you know, require nor use a lot of you know, money or anything like that. You know, none of the developers are paid, and we don't really. You know, we have some donations we've been sitting on. They were for servers and things like that. But we're not financially backed, if that's what you're asking. I do know a few schools that have adopted Arch more or less internally, though, for, you know, some of their classes and things like that. But I don't know of anything major.
So you were one of the developers on Pac-Man, correct?
That's correct.
And you're not developing as much now, are you?
I try to make it my primary focus, but, you know, there's only so many hours in the day, so...
Man, Pac-Man is a sweet package manager, I have to say. What's the philosophy behind Pac-Man? Because, I mean, it seems to be simple, and you know, easy to use and almost like apt and quick. What was the driving force behind Pac-Man to say, well, you know, we want a different package manager. We're going to do it like this. What was it that you guys found lacking in the other package managers?
I'm not entirely versed on the, you know, the original history of Pac-Man and why it came about, but I can tell you my opinion or my take on that. As far as I can tell, at the time that Arch was created, most of the other stuff out there either didn't have any complicated package manager, you know, Slackware doesn't do anything that complex as far as that goes. There was, of course, apt and things like that, but those are, it either requires like a PhD to build a package or to, you know, from scratch build a package. You know, it's just a very complicated format and process. Or they were just too unwieldy to work with. You know, in the case of RPMs, you miss a lot of dependencies and stuff like that. Or in the past, I don't want to make any claim. I haven't used an RPM distro in ages, but I remember in the past, you know, you would every so often miss dependencies because it wasn't top-notch. And I think all these little problems led to the inception of Pac-Man originally.
Did we lose our guest? Aaron, are you still there?
No, I'm still here.
Oh, I thought you cut. I thought that it sounded like you dropped out there for a second. Yeah, Pac-Man, when I first started using that, it was so simple. And to build a package for it is, you know, relatively easy. I mean, just a simple config file where you just drop, you know, put the dependencies in that thing, and you could build the package right up, and you're good to go. It takes you all of like 5 to 10 minutes to learn how to create a Pac-Man package. It's sweet. I'm trying to recall. Was there a package manager for Crux? Was that similar to what Pac-Man is now?
I don't believe they had a package manager, but what they did do, and still do, I believe, they use a package build format like we do. I think it's a little less involved, but they build most things from source.
Uh-huh.
Closer to, like, you know, the port system or something like that. Now, so I don't believe they actually have anything to install binary packages in it.
What I find pretty interesting about Arch is, Arch kind of flies under the radar of a lot of the Linux population, in that it doesn't have the popularity of Debian, SUSE, or Red Hat. Yet, its repositories, the packages in the repositories, are huge. There's a huge amount of packages in just the Arch repositories. And then you go look in the Arch user repositories, and it just, there's so many. It's surprising that you have such a vast repository for your distribution.
Yeah, it's a lot of work, and our packagers do great jobs, you know, keeping those things up to date and ensuring, you know, fairly decent quality for a vast majority of these packages.
Now, Arch operates on a rolling upgrade, correct? That you're constantly, you know, the current is the live is the testing. Is that correct?
Well, we do, the current is live, but we do have a separate testing repository, so there is a bit of a delay before things go live. But one of the important things to note about the whole rolling release thing is that we don't support older versions. And one of the nice things, in my opinion, that comes from this is we don't have to worry about security fixes and things like that as much. Because, you know, if there's a bug in version 1.7 and 1.8's out, well, we're already providing 1.8. We don't have to patch 1.7.
And that's nice. We had a question come in from the IRC regarding Arch, and it's from Verbal. And the question is, what, in your opinion, is the one thing that trips up most new Arch users?
I see a lot of different issues. One of the really common ones I see is that they'll install Arch and reboot and be dropped directly in the console, expecting, you know, something more into a GUI or something like that. it's a little off-putting, but I think a lot of people are going to, you know, kind of roll with that. If they're unable to roll with that, that's, you know, the whole command line thing throws a lot of people off, especially coming from the Windows world and some of the more, quote, user-friendly distributions, which, you know, give you these layers of abstraction. Of course, you command line tests.
I have a question regarding the AUR. You have a lot of packages that are in the main repositories, and then you have the AUR. What's the difference between AUR and regular repository package?
The AUR packages are, they're supplied by the community. They're not, I don't want to say officially supported, but they're not, you know, like we don't have anybody packaging them actively. So they're not, they're available only in package build form where you would download it and build it from source. Now, most of the time, the packages in the AUR are the less common or less popular packages. If they become really popular or really necessary or something like that, they usually get bumped up. We have trusted users who package things for the community repository, which sits on top of the AUR. And again, depending on popularity, may bump up to extra, which is our official package repository.
Now, what's the process for contributing user packages? Is there any guidelines you have to follow?
There's some guidelines, but they're, I don't want to say they're necessary because, you know, the packaging guidelines are there on our wiki. You know, people make mistakes, and the trust users are around to kind of say, you know, hey, I like this package, but, you know, you should probably do this or that, or this doesn't fit the guidelines type thing. As far as providing packages to the AUR, it's fairly straightforward. You know, sign up for a user account and a package build. There's some validation that takes place, so as best as we can do. So, you know, it will reject, you know, erroneous package builds and things like that. But for the most part, it's a very straightforward process.
If there's an area of packages that you might want more user contributions, is there any particular need that you're looking for?
Me personally, I guess I could be considered a fairly conservative Linux user. I don't use a lot of the fancy iCandy or any of that type of stuff. But I believe that stuff is always important. Anything that looks fancy, anything that involves transparency, people love. And most people can't seem to get enough of it. So as far as the fancy-looking GUI apps, there's always a need for that, I guess.
What about a graphical package builder? Has anybody built one of those yet? I don't see the point, but...
You mean a front-end of Pac-Man?
Yeah.
There's a few front-ends of Pac-Man. I don't know if there's a front-end to actually building a package, but... GUI front-ends to installing packages, there's a few. I don't know what state they're in anymore, especially since we released the 3.0 release of Pac-Man. I think a couple of them, due to some of the changes we made, a couple of GUI Pac-Man front-ends kind of went by the wayside. I believe there's a Java one that's still around, Jackman. And I saw another one the other day. But yeah, there are a couple provided by the community.
We had a question from the RC, Aaron. Someone wanted to know whether you guys do any patching to any of the software, or it's just stock, whatever was out there.
That's a part of the Arch philosophy in a way. We try our hardest, I guess, not to, you know, patch or modify the software too much. We try to supply what the original author intended. Typically, you know, when we patch things, it's usually to, you know, either make it compile on, say, GCC4 or maybe be compatible with another one of our packages that is the latest and greatest version. They haven't updated yet or something along those lines. Additionally, sometimes we'll patch things to change the default configuration of the app to be more sane, which is another one of our little philosophy points, the whole same default. Either buggy security issues due to, you know, some defaults, or things along those lines.
We have another question in from our chat room, and that is, you kind of maybe have answered this, but I'll ask it again, or what the question is, and that is, in your opinion, what distribution does Arch resemble, or closely resemble, aside from Crux, would you say?
Oh, that's a tough one. I see this question every so often. I never really know how to answer it. I know Arch originally came from Crux, but I don't think it resembles Crux that much anymore. I think idealistically, it's kind of closer to Slackware, but I might anger some people by saying that. That's just my opinion. I think it's closer to Slackware with some of the Crux ideals still floating around.
I can see that. I can see that. Now, is Arch supporting any other textures other than Intel 80x86?
Currently, we support i686 and the x86-64, which is 64-bit architecture. Currently, that's it. There is a PPC project. I actually do not know the current state of Arch on PPC hardware. That I think might, I don't know, I think the whole Intel Max kind of threw a curveball at that one. I'd love to see other architectures. I think that'd be great. But as of right now, we don't have any projects going forward besides those two architectures.
Isn't there like an unofficial AMD 64 port? I remember we were at Linux World in Boston a couple of years back. And we had met one of the Arch community members, and he was talking about doing an AMD 64 port at the time.
If we're talking about the same thing, that port is official. We do have a 64-bit architecture that we supply. I don't know if it was originally the same thing that was the AMD 64 architecture. The architecture we support is x86-64, which includes Intel and AMD and those things.
Now, are you running Arch Linux on all your systems?
Yes, I believe so.
And do you run any other distributions aside from Arch, or do you keep up on what other distributions are doing?
I have one machine that I really don't do a whole lot with, so I think right now it has like four different OSs on it. One of them being Arch, the other one being FreeBSD. I have an install of Gabo Linux on there.
What is
that? And that it's a another smaller distribution. I think they made their namesake by changing the file system hierarchy. You know, instead of slash bin, they have like slash programs and things like that.
Oh, okay, I think I recall that now.
I almost want to say a Plan 9 on there as well, but I doubt it.
Ah, Plan 9. Whew. You know what? Speaking of changing the file system, I noticed that Arch, unlike other distributions, puts an awful lot of software into the op directory. And why is that?
Well, all right, two things here. First off, we are working to push things out of opt. In my own personal opinion, I think we have a lot of stuff in opt simply because it was easier to put it there than to kind of shoehorn it into the FHS standard. And that's the reason we use opt in the first place. We have these packages that don't conform to the FHS standard. They don't put things in the directories that the standard says they should, so we decided, well, let's just stick them in opt for now and let them, you know, do their own thing with their directories. That way we don't violate anything.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I thought there used to be a lot more software in opt than's in there now. I'm just looking at what's in there now. And KDE is all in opt, isn't it?
Yeah, and I believe that's changing soon. I don't want to make any promises here, but that should be changing soon. We're trying to move most of the Mozilla stuff out of opt. there's a few things that are a little harder, like Java and things of that nature.
Now, does that make putting the stuff in op, does that make administration for you guys on your end a lot more simple?
I don't know. I don't think it makes it harder or easier for us. I think it's more of a philosophy point. Like, you know, we don't want to, you know, put random named directories at the root level and things like that. We don't want to mess with the directory structure. So we'll just, you know, basically quarantine them in their own little directory.
So when you're running and in charge of a distribution like Arch, I'm curious to know, do you have, or is there a lot of concern with regards to, well, of course, there's probably concern with regards to security, but do you ever have people trying to slip malicious stuff into packages?
I've always wondered about this myself. Like, we always talk about it, especially with the AUR, you know, with people being able to basically upload build scripts. Anybody could upload something that has malicious code in it. This is part of the reason why we have the barrier between the normal AUR user and the trusted user. Because they're able to kind of, like, evaluate that sort of stuff. But because we do this sort of, I guess, privilege separation, we haven't really run into anything. And I don't know if anybody's ever come across a package built in the AUR that had malicious code in it. I'm curious of that, too.
Yeah, because, I mean, I don't think I've ever really heard that happening on any... I mean, I've heard of like, some repository servers, mirrors getting hacked... by or cracked by some for some distributions, but nothing that I've ever heard that they've compromised any packages for a specific distribution. It'd be interesting to learn more about that, or if it's actually happened out there. Have you heard anything, Pat?
No, I haven't actually. Not recently.
So as part of your duties are also in conjunction with maintaining the distribution, you have to maintain the community too. I mean, you ever have what do you find more difficult, managing the software or managing the people behind the software?
I think people are always more difficult to deal with. There's too many different kinds of people. You run into all sorts. You run into people who are, like you mentioned the Lilo thing, you know, that you didn't run Lilo or whatever. Most people will take that in stride and say something like, oh, well, I forgot that, oh, crap. Every so often you get the people who will blame you. Every so often you get the people who are just really mad and you know, threatening lawsuits or something. Not that that's ever happened, but, you know, you get different reactions for all sorts of things. So I'd say people are much, much more difficult.
Yeah, I can understand that. So you guys...
One of my favorite features about Arch Linux is the simplicity of the configuration. A lot of the configuration for the system is inside of the etcrc.conf file. Who originally thought that up? Was it a design thing early on?
I want to say that was originally Judd's idea, but don't quote me on that. The single configuration file for all this sort of stuff. I assume other systems have done it in the past, but you know we try as best as we can to stick to this single RCConf thing, and I hear that a lot. Like, this is, you know, a main selling point that the configuration of basically the entire system, as far as the nitty-gritty low-level stuff goes, is in one file. It makes it really easy to deal with. And I agree with that.
So as you guys are progressing with Arch, are there any major projects or changes planned for Arch in the upcoming future?
Any major changes? I don't think we have anything major planned that would be, you know, worth talking about. I mean, there are, of course... things are constantly changing. I actually have a list in front of me right now of about four or five things I'm going to do tonight before I sleep. So, you know, there's always significant changes coming down the pipeline, but I don't think we have anything major planned.
When you're maintaining Arch, what is the most difficult group of packages to maintain, in your opinion?
I would say the most difficult group of packages... are actually those maintained by Tobias, and these are actually the kernel and UDEV and basically all these sort of packages that deal with your hardware. Dealing with hardware, it's so variable. that, you know, testing it is very difficult and making sure it works on all systems, this sort of stuff. I would say those are the single hardest things to deal with. And Device does a great job doing that, by the way.
So speaking of testing then, what do you guys do to actually test your system out? I mean, you probably have a handful of developers that do as much testing as possible. But, there's just an infinite amount of flexibility out there and different hardware combinations that it must be almost impossible, you know, to say, hey, you know, we're good to go to move this from test to live. You know, how do you make that decision and all that?
I think as far as, you know, hardware and modules and the kernel go and anything that's hardware-oriented, basically, we need to kind of differentiate between a perfect package and something that's good enough. And, you know, it is possible that something that worked yesterday won't work today in a package. And, you know, if we try to test these things as best we can among the developers, if the developers don't have the hardware to test it, you know, we try to pull in different community members to test. But odds are if we tested a package for, like, let's say 4 or 5 days or some kernel module for 4 or 5 days and it didn't have any errors on the systems we tested it on, odds are if there are any issues, it's going to be on the more esoteric hardware that not a lot of people have. And I know it's kind of gambling a little, but, you know, if it's rarer hardware, odds are, you know, as a smaller distribution, we won't run into these issues. In the future, though, you know, we probably will move to a more formal, like, hardware testing thing. I don't want to delay release. You know, we kind of strive for the bleeding edge of packages, trying to get things out as quick as we can. So I don't want to delay things for months while they sit in testing and they're tested. But, you know, we should, at least as far as hardware goes, begin testing the edge cases, I guess, a little bit harder than we do.
How many people are in the decision-making group?
Right now, it's more or less a democracy, I guess. You know, when we have something that's contentious, we just kind of throw the question out there and go for a majority vote among the developers. Every so often, there are things that, you know, can't be decided or they argued about for too long. And at that point, then it's usually, you know, up to me or somebody else to kind of say, hey, listen, we're just going to go this way rather than wasting time arguing about it. But for the most part, I guess you could say we're a democracy.
That's cool. Ooh, what's the name of the current release of Arch? It's not Noodle, is it?
The current release is named Don't Panic.
Don't Panic. Where do you get your release names from?
We just kind of make them up.
Okay.
A couple of times we ask the community for good names. Most of the time, you know, we do the democratic vote thing. You know, people throw out their ideas and we just kind of vote, see which one we like best.
Don't Panic.
I have a question. If there's one area of improvement for Arch Linux, what do you think it is? Where can you improve it?
One area of improvement. Boy. I would say, and I don't mean this in any sort of negative way towards people that may take offense, but I think what we actually need is more people involved in the coding of our tools that we use to manage our distribution. Right now we have, you know, a few things that may or may not be tedious tasks to some, and me personally, when I come across a tedious task, I throw code at it. Fix it by writing a script or a program or whatever. And we have a lot of these semi-tedious tasks that I would like to see, you know, replaced by code instead of people to give us more free time to do, well, better things for Arch.
Another question from the IRC regarding your logo. When are you going to be picking a logo?
This, just in case you know, this wasn't covered. We did have a logo contest recently where we had, you know, community submissions and all these sorts of things. We took this internal, and the developers voted on the top five. At this point, we were going to go through and do a trademark search to see you know, trademarking this logo as the Linux logo, just in the off chance that somebody were to try to steal it or something along those lines. Right now, we're kind of stuck at that point. The legal stuff always takes a long time. But I've been trying, you know, for the past couple of days to speed this process along and see what we can do about it, getting this done fast, because I know, especially the people who participated in the contest are, you know, kind of itching for the results. But we do at least have finalists. If that makes you feel better.
Do you have a page that has all the user-submitted logos there?
Those are on the forums. In the announcements section, there's a logo contest entries that Travis kept track of. I can't remember how many entries we had. We had a lot.
I'll have to go over to forums and look for that. You know, I really like Arch's website, too. It's clean. It's, are you in charge of maintaining that website, or?
Me personally? No. I have no visual skills whatsoever. We have Elliot, Simo, and a couple of the other guys to thank for that, especially the UI, actually, the layout and the CSS and all that stuff originally came from a community member a while back. I can't remember how long we had the current layout.
Do you like how it has the most recent updates over there and, you know, interesting package repositories? And it's just, I just find it really interesting.
Yeah, there's RSS feed to that, too, which I use quite a lot.
And then you can see all the release names, too. Good stuff. So when's the next major release going to be rolling around? Do they expect that after the new year?
Well, we've been trying to match our releases because, you know, of course, we do the whole rolling release thing, so our actual releases aren't that big of a deal. We just release a new ISO with a new installer and things like that. We've been trying to match that to the kernel, but this time of year, it's really hectic for people, so we may or may not get one out before the new year.
That's, there you go. That's ambitious. Such a nice website. It is. It's like one of my favorite websites for a distribution. Because everything you want, you know, it's not hard to find anything on this. Documentation right at your fingertips. Forums are right there. You don't have to dig down. It's just, I think, so well designed. Now, when you did the logo competition, is that the logo you're looking at in the upper left-hand corner, what you're looking to replace with an official logo?
Or? Yes. Yeah, we decided with the whole, you know, new leader and this type of thing, we would just, you know, kind of freshen the, I think the terminology used was freshen our graphical identity. But yeah, we were just looking to replace things and then change things up.
Don't change the website. It's beautiful.
I'll pass that on.
It's so wonderful. How many different languages do you guys support?
Most of that is community contributions. As far as our wiki sees a huge amount of translations. I can't even, I mean, you know, it varies from page to page. I think I've seen one with like 8 or 9 different languages on there. Pac-Man itself has been translated into a lot of different languages. Just to name a few, anyway, we have Italian, French, Hungarian, and ENGB, which is always the funniest translation.
Wow.
We got a question from the IRC. One of the guys wants to know, are there any Arch derivatives out there, other distributions?
There's a couple. I think one of the most promising, one of my favorites, I don't even know if you'd call it an Arch derivative, is Frugalware. And Frugalware is kind of like a mix between Slackware and Arch. They use a derivative of Pac-Man and Makepackage and all the different tools that we use. But I believe, now I may be wrong here, I might get yelled at, I believe their versions and their packages follow Slackware's. There's a few live CD distributions out there. Archie, I don't even know how you would say Larch. I would say L-Arch, but that's probably not correct. There was Rubix, I want to say. I don't know what happened to them. I don't know if they're still around or not. I haven't heard much recently. There's probably a bunch more that I'm forgetting.
I've got another question for you, Aaron. In the past, going back a couple of years, there were some issues when you guys were doing package updates where things would break. I know it caused a lot of people in the community some grief, you know, because they had to deal with the breakages. What were some of the steps that you and the other developers took to help prevent this from happening in the future?
Like I was saying before, we don't really have a very rigorous testing thing. We are trying to walk the fine line between getting things out to people as quick as possible and getting things out to people as good a quality as possible. And it's a hard line to walk, and sometimes we screw up and people yell. One of the things we've done recently is we used to have two repositories named Current and Extra. And the current repository had a lot of stuff in there, a lot of important packages, but it wasn't, at least in my opinion, wasn't very well defined. There wasn't anything that said these are the packages in Current and these are the packages in Extra. So what we've done is we've kind of removed that little barrier and renamed the current repository to the core repository. And this core repository contains the core packages of the distribution, the important ones that absolutely should not break. And, you know, because we do have this distinction, it allows us to pay more careful attention to these packages in the core repo, because we know if any of them break, we'll most likely break somebody's system. So as long as the core repo's in good shape, we shouldn't have any, you know, deal breakers as far as packages go.
When you talk about the core system, you mean like the kernel, the libraries, you know, utilities?
Yeah, the kernel, network modules, UDEV, all those sorts of things that, you know, your system needs to boot and basically just run most things.
Yeah, I started with Arch a few years back, and I really liked the simplicity of it. I liked how the system was laid out. I loved the package manager. I thought Pac-Man was great. I loved, you know, how EdCRC configuration was set up. You know, it didn't hold your hand. That didn't bother me because I'm a fairly experienced Linux user, and I used Slackware for a long time. I was a Debian user when Debian was considered difficult. So using Arch wasn't difficult for me. Some people complain about the installer that it doesn't do everything for you automatically, but that's okay. I mean, it's not very difficult. I recently did an install on my laptop, and I thought the install process went much better than what I originally remember it from a few years back. I thought it was pretty straightforward. The documentation pretty much guided you along. You know, has it been an effort to make the installer better?
See, that's one of the funny things. There has been an effort to make the installer better, but the simple fact is a lot of people, when they install Arch, they don't reinstall it for years. Like me personally, I haven't seriously used our installer beyond testing it in maybe 2 years. So it's one of these things where, like, you use it and you think, like, huh, we could improve this or we could improve that, and then you don't use it for months because, you know, the system runs, you don't need to install anything and this sort of stuff. So it's one of those things where, at least me personally, I view it as it works as is. It's not perfect, but it's not a deal breaker. It's not critical that we make it better because it does work. I do think it needs improvement. And if anybody, you know, out there in the wild wants to work on some Arch code, that's a perfect place to start. Hint, hint.
We have a question from the IRC. Verbal wants to know whether, Aaron, are you a KDE or a GNOME man or something else?
I'm neither. This is always kind of a weird question for me. I actually use Rat Poison.
So you like the lighter desktops and window managers?
I just like the way I agree with the philosophy of it, the basically the one full screen window at a time, that philosophy. I don't like, you know, part of the reason I don't like these tiling window managers is that, you know, they split up your screen real estate. I'm only doing one thing at a time, so why do we need to see five things at a time? But, you know, that's just my opinion.
So as long as you have a whole bunch of terminal sessions open, you're happy?
Yeah, yeah.
VI or Emacs?
VI. Don't believe you.
Is your background more of a Linux administrator or a programmer?
I'd say programmer.
Well, Aaron, you guys do a fantastic job with the Arch Linux project. I really like the philosophy, and I kind of like, you know, the area where you guys are trying to hit. You're kind of in between. To me, my impression of Arch is you guys are kind of in between Slackware with, you know, with the package management of, like, Debian, kind of in that in-between sweet spot, you know? And I think that's a really nice place to be.
Yeah, it is.
You know, Slackware is a gate distribution. I've used it, you know, as my primary distro for a couple of years. You know, the guys on the show, Dan and Link and Alan and members of our local log, they all love Slackware back in the day. And we still run it, you know, to a certain capacity here and different things. To me, my biggest gripe with Slackware was package management system or the lack of one thereof. I know you can do packages. I know there's linuxpackages.net. You know, Slack is great, you know, but for me it wasn't enough. I think Arch kind of takes what Slackware does and brings it to, like, another level.
Yeah, that sounds about like how I feel about it. I ran Slackware back in the day, too. I think it was the second distribution I ever tried.
It's great, you know. These guys still love it, you know. I don't think any of us, though, are still running it as our primary distro. Most of us have migrated to other distributions. I run mostly Ubuntu, some Debian, and Arch. And I think Dan is about the same. He has, I think some of the servers that he has still run Slackware.
Who are you talking about?
And your works, how many Slack boxes are you still running, Dan?
The server runs Slackware.
Which one?
My server.
The Forum?
The Icecast server, the Linux, the Forum, the email. I have, my main workstation runs Arch, and my music server runs Arch.
Very nice.
Yeah, my laptop, I got Arch. It's nice.
People always seem to question how good Arch is on laptops, but I've been running it on mine for, I've had it on my last two laptops, so if that's an answer for anybody.
I love Arch on the laptop because it's so blazing fast to boot up.
I'm trying to think whether I ever ran Arch on a laptop. I can't remember. I don't think I did. No, I ran Crux PPC on a PowerBook for a little while. But I don't think I used to run Arch. I was running Arch for almost everything there for a while. It was my main workstation at work. It was my main workstation at home. And now it's just my main workstation at home. I gave in to the peer pressure of Ubuntu at work.
I like Ubuntu. It's nice for what it does, you know. It's a very different mentality, though, from what Arch is, you know.
I used one or two of their live CDs at some point, but never really got the drive to install it.
We got another question from the RC. What's your favorite programming language?
I almost want to be philosophical here and not answer that question, but that'd be way too dorky. I would say right now I have a lot of fun programming Python. I really like writing in Python, but my heart still goes out to C++. It was the language I broke my teeth on, I guess.
Now, are you a developer by in your regular job, a programmer?
That's correct.
And do you what do you program for your day job? Is that C++?
It's a lot of different things. Anymore, I do a lot of Flash, ActionScript, C#, Python, mostly Windows work.
So you do a lot of work in the .NET framework?
Not a whole lot. I haven't done a whole lot in, I just want to say 6 months.
So what's your opinion of Mono, then?
I like what they're trying to do. I just feel like they could simplify things a bit more. It's fairly complex to do anything with Mono, including installing Mono applications. It's fairly, it takes a few hours to get Mono set up nicely, and I think they could simplify that and make it a lot easier than they actually do.
So it sounds like you do a lot of Windows development in your day job. So you work in primarily in Microsoft environments.
Yep.
So what drew you to Linux?
I don't know. Somebody asked me that question a while ago, and I think it was just back years ago. I was just kind of looking for something new and playing around, and it was when Linux was kind of becoming the talk of the town. I had a friend who got I don't even remember what it was. I think it was a Mandrake CD in a magazine, and I had a spare computer, so I installed it, and that was that.
So when you get home from work at night, You switch from the Microsoft environment into a Linux environment, yes?
Yes.
And then you have to get up in the morning and go back to a Microsoft environment. How do you find that frustrating at all?
Actually, no. Anymore with the way open source software is going on my computer at work, I have pretty much the same stuff installed as I do here. It's just that it has a little bar on the bottom that says Start in the left corner. I still have Firefox. I have PuTTY, so I can SSH different places, and all these different apps, which are pretty much the exact same as the ones I'm running at home.
What about virtual desktops?
yeah, I'm a rat poison user. I don't do that.
Okay.
That's way too complex for me.
Well, that answers that question. So now, if you're using all these applications, the same applications that you use on Windows that you use on Linux, why not just install Linux on your workstation at work? Or were they frowned upon that?
I'd love to, but, as it is right now, I work in a lot of technologies that are either very difficult to use portably on Linux or impossible. I mean, for instance, as I was saying, I do a lot of Flash work, and right now you can't do pretty much any complex Flash work in a non-Windows environment.
So what's your opinion of Flash on Linux?
Without going into too many details here, we've had a couple of installations that I've done, with standalone machines that involve some Flash and things like that. And I would say maybe half of them at some point ran Linux, whereas, most of the time it's Windows. But we have installed Linux on a machine to run this Flash software. So, in my opinion, it's stable enough. It's not perfect, but it's stable enough.
So, if I'm not mistaken, I believe that Flash 9 Release 3 came out this past week for Linux.
I don't actually know.
Yeah, Stephen Von Nichols wrote an article, and basically he says, it implements H.264 now, but it seems to be a lot slower than the previous versions of it. I haven't tried it.
Yeah, I haven't tried it yet either. Maybe I should go install. I want to install it now.
Dan's going to recompile the kernel during the show.
I don't need to recompile the kernel anymore. Arch takes care of all that for me.
Well, we try.
Everything's modular these days. What do you need to recompile for?
It's true. I can't remember the last time I did a kernel compile.
I've only done one.
What happened to Link?
He says he wasn't feeling good. He dropped off.
Oh. Ay, 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 ay.
Sudden case of the HIV.
What are you going to do? So what do you prefer there, VI or Emax?
We asked that already, Dan.
Oh, that must have been one of my kids to bed. So you use rat poison, and what do you use for an email client? Mutt, right?
Well, you know, I used to use Mutt a lot more, and I try to keep using it, but anymore I just use Gmail.
Ah.
I know it makes me a traitor, but...
A traitor to what? What's wrong with Gmail?
I like it personally, but, you know, I'm being a traitor to my Mutt roots.
Can't you set up Mutt to retrieve your mail from Gmail?
Yeah, I actually do that. I just can't ever bring myself to actually sit. When I'm at home, I can't ever sit down and use Mutt when I have Firefox open.
Ah, there you go. When are we going to see Arch pre-installed on machines for sale at Walmart?
Oh, that would be cool.
It's a good question. Let me know when that happens.
That would be awesome. Yeah,
do you have any idea how many Arch users are there? Is there any ballpark figure?
Oh, I actually have no idea, and I wouldn't even want to estimate that. I'll probably be wildly wrong. I think the best count we have, well, we have Arch Stats, which is a daemon that runs on machines to collect, you know, packages installed and common packages and things like that. And I think that has a fairly accurate user count, though I'm not entirely sure. I haven't checked in a while. I have to ask Simo about that one.
Well, Aaron, you guys do a great job over at the Arch Linux project. I definitely, you know, suggest people check it out, especially if they're experienced Linux users and they're looking for something a little new. There's one misconception, though, that I find about Arch some people write about. Some people are under the assumption that Arch is a source-based distribution, and it's not really. It's packages. I mean, yeah, it's pretty easy to do compiles yourself using, you know, whatever is out there, but for the most part, it's a binary package distribution.
That's correct.
But you guys do a great job. You know, we really appreciate you taking the time to come onto the show and talk to us. We wish you all the best, you know, in the new role that you're doing with the project, and you're always welcome to come back to the show.
Thank you very much. It was nice talking to you guys.
Thank you very much. Have a great evening, and a happy holiday.
Merry Christmas to you.
Same to you.
Merry Christmas.
Dun, dun, dun. Is Link coming back?
I don't think so, Dan. He dropped off, and he wasn't feeling well, he said.
Ha, I like talking with him. I like Arch.
Arch is a nice distribution.
He's angry. His cell phone was angry.
Who's angry?
His cell phone was angry.
It was a little annoying. What are you going to do?
Hey, you know what? He came on to talk to us, and that's all that's matters.
Exactly.
That's what's important. All you naysayers and haters. So let me explain what happened last week, because now I got a better picture as to what's going on. Then we can roll right into the other interesting stuff. Because we have, what, an hour at least? What time is it?
About 50 minutes, 45 minutes.
Okay. Last week, my system went down again. It locked up. And
you thought it was the CPU, right?
I did, because when I got it back up and running and started looking into things, it locked up again on me while I was working on the show. And we think, how did this go?
Well, we came back to listen to the interview, and through the phone connection,
right,
it just stopped working. It just went silent from our perspective.
Yeah, it did do that. But, well, in a nutshell, I took apart my system that night, and I noticed that there was an awful lot of dust bunnies in it. And I suspected that it was overheating. And I believed that's exactly what was going on. I've cleaned it out, cleaned out all the dust bunnies, took apart my, took the fan off the processor and the heat sink and cleaned that thoroughly and put it back together. And it wouldn't come back on. And I was like freaking out because I thought I fried my processor. It would do one of those things where you would push the power button in and it would start up for a couple seconds and then drop off for like a second and a half and then just die. So after, you know, fiddling around with it for a little bit, I finally finished the show, I think, on my laptop. And the next day, that night I went and ordered a new processor. The best I could find, I wanted to find something that would fit exactly into my motherboard. It's an AMD Athlon 2700. What I could find at the time was an AMD Athlon 2600. So on a pinch, I ordered that because I wanted to get my system back up and running. The next day, I figured I'd play around with it some more, see what was going on. I thought it might be issues regarding the heat sink and not sitting properly on the processor. I didn't have any of the grease compound in between it anymore. So I had put some of that on order too. So I've managed to get the heat sink on there so it was operating properly and would actually turn on, but then I would get these consecutive beeps. It would just beep and beep and beep. So I figured, you know, this sounds like a memory problem now. So I tried reseating my memory. I tried cleaning the slot the memory was in. Nothing was working. So then I figured, okay, well, I'll move the memory. I put it in the middle slot. That didn't work. I put it in the third slot, and it worked, which is odd because I don't know why. I don't remember pulling the memory out and putting it in a different slot, but it just, you know, it started working. So it ran for a little while, and then it would die, and it would still be on, but the screen would never come back. It would freeze up or something. So I rebooted it, and I couldn't get anything off of my video display. So I figured, oh, man, maybe my video card's hosed. So I pulled the video card out, tried, you know, messing, cleaning that, making sure everything looks fine, put it back in, reseating it. Nothing worked. I pulled out an older video card. I had a TNT, not a TNT, it was a GeForce 2 or 3 or something, and 64 megs on it. Threw it in there, and that was working. So I must have somehow fried my video card in the process of everything. Maybe I'll try it again sometime in the future, see if it works on this different system. So since I got my system back up and running again, I had this processor coming, and I'm like, well, I don't need the processor now.
What kind of processor is it?
And it's just an AMD 2600. So I said to my wife, you know, I can get a motherboard for this processor. Like $26 it was, and start, you know, chucking some other. I could build us a Myth TV box, and she gave me the go ahead to do that.
All right,
so,
Dan.
Yeah, I have the processor,
getting
the motherboard,
yeah,
and the fan, and the DVD player coming. I have.
Oh, you
needed
the capture card, man. Get a Hot Pog 150.
Yeah, I'm looking into that. I need
$50 on eBay.
Yeah, I need a case, and you know, a hard drive, and a few other things. But we're going to look into CompUSA is closing up its shops. So just see if there's any good deals we can get from there after the holiday when they're liquidating all their stuff, because there's a CompUSA around here.
Yeah, the one by me, by my office, there used to be one, and they closed up the last round of closures when, what was that, like 3-4 months ago?
Yeah.
I mean, they were not the cheapest CompUSA, but it was convenient having a computer store nearby where you can go
uh-huh.
and pretty much get anything you wanted to if you needed.
Yeah, so I'm going to check that out and build this Myth TV box. And right now I got everything back together. So I decided in conjunction with that, trying to reduce the noise over here in this office, I pulled out all my other systems, and I have this mobile rack that I got from Link a few years ago, and
weighs like 150 pounds.
Yeah, it is heavy as hell, but it's on wheels, so I can pull it in and out, which is convenient. And I had my server and another machine on the top, and then two other machines on the bottom. Like, so I pulled out all the machines and took them apart and cleaned them. And man, there was so much dust and hair in those things. It was just a whole new cat that came out of that thing.
Mm.
It was all dusty. I could put together, you know, I could rebuild the dog we lost with the hair that came out of there. So I moved the server to the bottom and far away. It's tucked in the corner. I also noticed that 3COM switch that I had was plugged in and flailing away. And that was like the majority of the noise coming from that. So I fixed everything, you know, cleaned it all out. The noise subsequently was significantly reduced. You can still hear a little bit of a hum, but not as much. It's not like it used to be before. Almost deafening. So, you know, that's where I am with the office over here. And hopefully things will stay stable and be good to go.
Cool. Glad you didn't have to, you know, go out on your lungs to get a completely new system.
Yeah, that's nice. You know, I dread the day
and
when...
And you scored a new one, too.
Yeah, a Myth box. I dread the day when I have to replace the server, though.
Why is that? You just have much shit on there?
It's just
hard to find a good turbo server.
Yeah, it's just a pain in the butt, you know? I'm thinking to myself, I'm looking at all this stuff here, God, some of the stuff we're doing the show on is like 7-8 years old.
Oh, yeah, crusty stuff, man.
I mean, the server itself is a good... It's got to be at least 6 years old. And the box that does the Dynabolic is... That's running a live CD is like 8 years old.
Well, what's the spec on the machine that you're streaming with?
The Dynabolic?
Yeah.
It's like a Pentium 3, I think. Hold on, let me look. Oh, yeah, it's a Pentium 3. It's like a 450. Yeah, it's old. It was an old machine from where I used to work that was like really, heavily used too. But they're all functioning and working just fine. Clean them out and they're happy again.
What do you think is the one piece of hardware that fails the most? To me, it's either hard drives and fans, power supplies too.
You mean overall? Yeah, hard drives for me.
I think I got one fan short in my desktop box right now. I got to get replaced. I shut it down over the weekend to do some tests on it because I think I got bad memory chip in there as well, because every once in a while it just slows to a crawl. When I turned it back on, the fan, it was like dying. These dying noises, like...
Was this your Apple, Alan?
No, this is the desktop box. It's my Linux box.
Yeah, power supplies usually burn out. I've had a couple of those go. Usually, a lot of those power supplies are like the most cheapest things in there. And believe it or not, a power supply is one of the most important things of your system because everything, is feeding off of it.
True.
It's definitely worth spending, an extra $20-$30 and getting a good power supply.
I've had a couple power supplies go myself. I hate that.
I had one go, but it was in an old E-machine, so...
Yeah, those boxes from those places like E-machines and Dell, they're usually the crappiest power supplies ever.
Although, the other one that I bought at the same time is still cranking along, so... Every once in a while, you just get a bad one, and that's all you can do.
Dun, dun, dun.
So what do you guys think about Nokia attacking Axiora?
I had a long discussion about this with Trolls yesterday.
I guess we should give a little bit of a background of exactly what happened.
Go ahead.
You want to do it?
You know what? You go ahead and do it, because I'm basing, the discussion I had with him yesterday was based upon an article where Nokia was asking for Og to be removed, and I read their PDF that they released, and that's it. So you probably have a little more information than I do on the rest of the story.
Right. What is it? Is it the W3C? They're doing...
Yeah.
HTML5 working draft, which is supposed to be like a summary of all web technologies that are considered standards. And they talk about different things, different components and what's used, what they want to use for different things and what's considered the de facto standard for web in the future. And one of the aspects they were talking about was video. And Axiora, which is the free unencumbered video codec that's out there that, a lot of free software people push, was in there. And Nokia, as well as I believe Apple and I think Microsoft to a certain degree, put the pressure on to get Axiora ripped out. Now, their contention was that there are some kind of patents behind Og Theora that might crop up in the future that we didn't know about initially. That was their argument. To me, that sounded like a big load of crap. But anyhow, that was their bone of contention. They said that we'd rather go with, you know, a patent covered codec where we know who owns the patents, we can do the licensing, it implements DRM, which is a good thing. And that's pretty much it. And it's kind of sad in a way. You know, Nokia, which is a pretty big company, you know, they've done some good things for open source software and free software, especially with, you know, the 770 and 800 and the NA10, you know, handheld tablets, you know, to a lesser degree with their smartphones, you know, and then you hear about this, and it's kind of a bummer, you know.
No, I do agree with you. I read their PDF, and I am not exactly sure why they feel Theora is encumbered. I also read a lot of what you sent me, link-wise. You sent an email. What the hell? Where was it? You sent on the topics for tonight from rud-o, rudd-o.com, a little bit about removal of Og Vorbis and Theora from HTML5, an outrageous disaster. I saw a lot in there about concerns about the Vorbis group challenging any encumbered technology or proprietary technology in Vorbis, but I'm not too sure about Theora, what they've done to show that Theora is not encumbered. And still, I'm not exactly sure why they feel Theora is encumbered. The PDF that Nokia put out did not go into detail as to what they felt was encumbered with regards to Theora. It's kind of
sad, though, you know.
It is.
To do this.
I don't know. It's a tough. I can almost see a little bit from their point as to the risk involved in using an encumbered technology, submarine patents and stuff like that. Whereas if you take something like H.264, which is what they're proposing to be the standard, H.264 and AAC for audio, there aren't any submarine patents that might that they know of that are going to jeopardize H.264 and AAC. It's already patented technology. It's encumbered to begin with. You need to pay a license to the MPEG for royalty. And I'm not sure about AAC. Who owns the AAC?
That's Apple, isn't it?
Is it Apple Audio Codec?
No, I don't think it's Apple, no.
You think it's licensed to them?
They license it. They use it, but I don't think it's actually owned by them. I have to look that one up, though.
Let me pull it up. Let me just. But, you know, and that's a problem. See, here's the thing, and this is something that's bothered me for a while. We brought it up on the show. Is you talk about open technology, and a lot of people misconstrue what is open and what is not open, and say that H.264 is an open technology, when in actuality it is not an open technology. It's not an open standard. It's a published standard, but it's not open. It's patent encumbered. You can't just implement H.264 based upon the published standard, because in order to do that, you need to pay a royalty to the MPEG group, which is really, by and large, confusing, because there's so many people out there that look at it and say, well, H.264 is an open technology, but it's not.
AAC, I think, is Fraunhofer, Fraunhofer ISS, or IIS, excuse me, which is the people who made up the MP3 format.
What's it stand for? Oh, advanced audio coding.
Yeah.
And see, now, file extensions are M4A, M4B, M4P, M4V, M4R, AAC, 3GP, MP4.
Yes, AUG is just a container like AVI.
Right.
But CR is video and Vorbis is the audio.
Right. So
this is regards to the Theora part.
Primarily what Nokia was saying in their PDF was the possibility of submarine patents hiding under the Theora technology. But they also made a reference to the fact that, you know, let's go with a more widely adopted, quote, standard that's out there now, and that being the H.264 for video, AAC for audio. That would give the support for many platforms that are already implementing these technologies. Almost kind of saying, let's look at what's popular and most widely used as opposed to what is freely available to be used. And by free, I mean what can be liberally used, what can be used without patent or without encumbrance. And so they're kind of going down the road of, you know, AAC and H.264 are so widely adopted by the majority of operating systems, DVD players, and other technologies. Let's just stick with what's there. And, you know, 99% of the people are going to be able to use it legally, is what the general gist of their argument sounds like. But that's, you know, and for the majority of the people, it almost seems like those technologies are free, so to speak. Because they're paying. You know, you buy Windows, you pay part of the license involved in Windows as a license to use those codecs. Same with Apple, same with a DVD player. It almost makes you say, well, if you're going to go down that path, right, if you buy a DVD drive, why not include the license to play those codecs in the cost of the DVD drive? Did you read that PDF, Pat?
I'm sorry, what'd you say?
Did you read that PDF? Nokia's
Which
PDF? The PDF that Nokia put out.
Not all the way through, partially.
It almost sounded like they were saying that people pay multiple times to be able to use those codecs. You know, you buy a DVD player, you're paying to be able to use MPEG technology. If you buy Windows, you're paying the license to use the MPEG technology. I'm wondering if you buy a DVD drive for your computer, are you paying for the license to use that technology? Is that incorporated into cost?
I don't think so. I mean, you hear about, you know,
not for just
Linux per se, playing back DVDs. I don't think you have the right to play back a DRM DVD. You have to get it's through the software player, not the actual physical drive.
Yeah, it's not the physical drive, yeah.
But, you know, here we are again going back and forth with, you know, regards to DRM. And I keep hearing time and again people saying the DRM technology is not going to last.
And then you have other people that saying it's not going to go away.
Right. I mean, who do you believe?
It will never go away. It allows them to. It allows companies to make money.
Exactly.
So it will never go away. It will always be broken, but it will never go away.
And by and large, who does it hurt in the end? It's primarily the legitimate customers.
Yeah, it goes back to the codec clusterfuck, you know? You have this big free-for-all with all these different codecs and everything. Different video codecs, different audio codecs. You know, everybody's got their own format that they're pushing. And, you know, I don't think it's going to change much. There might be newer codecs, audio codecs that have better quality with a smaller file size in the future that, you know, will make the old stuff obsolete. But everybody will have their own thing going, you know?
Well, by locking them, down the newer formats with DRM on it, you keep a business model going.
Of course. So they want to make money, you know.
Yeah, and that's all. So it's what it always is. It's never going to change.
It's like the whole
HD. We want to be, but it's just never going to change.
It's like the whole HD technology, man. They're really into using HDMI cable. That thing is the worst, man, the HDMI cable. That thing follows this HDCP copper protection scheme. And I'll give you an example. If I want to play back standard definition videos through my high-def DVD player, it won't do the upscaling unless you use the HDMI connection. If you hook up the TV through the component cables, it will not upscale. You'll get this pop-up message saying, unable to upscale, playing at 480i. Now, if you throw in, say, like a backed up DVD in there, it'll upscale it fine, no questions asked. You know, that's because
you didn't copy all the bits over.
Exactly, the bit flag isn't there. Yeah.
That's been around. That type of stuff has been around forever. I mean, I remember when I was doing mini discs all the time. Mini discs would allow you to make one digital copy. And after that the copy that you made always had the bit flag set that said, this is a copy, you can't make another one on it. So, you know, the way around that was actually just to make an analog copy. You know, you went through the analog hole, and you can make as many as you want. And they pretty much always sounded the same as long as you didn't crank up the volume on any of them. But, the PlayStation 3 downstairs, you know, it's a Bluetooth player, but I can't play Bluetooth because I don't have an HDMI cable on it.
Right.
I mean, the fact that I don't have HDMI TV doesn't help any, but, you know, I had it up here on my computer monitor, which is HD on it. It actually does conform to the HDMI standards. So if I plug in full HDMI stuff HDMI, it will actually, you know, play back anything you actually play into it on it. But, you know, it's still, you know, once I flipped it over, it was like, okay, yeah, it looks really nice, but I don't know. I wasn't too worried about it at that point.
What are you going to do?
Alan, you missed the lug meeting, man. It was a good meeting.
Yeah, I know. I screwed up on that one. I thought it was this weekend. I don't know why. I just totally ignored the fact that the first was actually Saturday. And I just, it was like 4:30 in the afternoon. I like all of a sudden, I'm like, it looked like the calendar. I was like, oh, wait, this is the second Saturday. That was it.
Yeah. It was good. It had a pretty good turnout. I didn't go last month because of the last month's meeting was on my son's birthday, and we had a party for him, so I couldn't go last month. But it was a good meeting. It was cool.
Cool.
What did you guys do at the meeting?
No, we just chit-chatted, hung out, shoot the breeze, you know, talking about Linux stuff. It was cool.
Yeah, I think I'll set up Google Calendar to actually. Oops. Dan, I hope you got a good backup here, or a good recording tonight, because Audacity just quit on me.
I hope we do, too. I hope it doesn't die. We're in deep shit.
And things, as it when it crashes, it was just like, it doesn't even give me back the files.
I know, I don't get it just, either. You're dead.
Oh, well, sorry about that.
Yeah, once you're dead, it's over. Game over.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why that's actually happening lately. I have to look into what's going wrong here. Something changed, but I'm not totally sure what. Because now every time I run Audacity, it runs for a little while and then just crashes. And I haven't updated it or anything, but maybe I should. I think it's the latest version, but.
I don't know.
Anything else you wanted to talk about, Dan?
What time is it?
Nothing. It's early. We got 20 minutes, man.
I don't know. What can we talk about? What else came out this
week?
No, go ahead and talk about the love mail.
We got some really good love mail this week, man. We're feeling the love, man. It's been good. We've had a bunch of emails, and they've been pretty positive.
Yeah, they have been.
Let me see. We got one from Christopher Schwab. He sent a nice one. Christian Herrens, he sent a nice one from Berlin, Germany.
Yes, thanks to all these people.
Yeah, people have been pretty damn cool, man. James Adorowski, I'm dropping docs here. Speaking of dropping docs, man, do you guys listen to a lot of Linux Links?
Not yet. It just came out the other day.
There's a new project from the BinRev guys and Droops. Hacker Public Radio. I guess it's Twatech version 2. And it sounds like Droops and Spankdog are going to be the main guys behind it.
Well, that's nice. That's really good.
I can understand some people not liking the name Twatech.
Oh,
thanks,
good.
Dan, for sharing.
Yeah. No, that's good. When is it slated to come out?
I think in January they're talking about it. You haven't done any recent episodes for Twat, have you, Dan?
No. I kind of dropped the ball on that.
Did you ask them to pull you from the rotation, or?
No, I never
just
did.
Just submit it.
I keep planning on doing it.
You just
did
submit them.
I just did submit them. I suck. I'm terrible.
Well, they keep coming out with new episodes, so people are still involved, which is a good thing.
Yeah, and it's some really good stuff. Oh, we have a question on the forum or on the chat about what's with the Linux Journal. Logo on our website. I forget what that's on there for. Aren't we supposed to be able to do some competitions and give away some subscriptions or something?
Yes. Link was handling that, so I don't know the details.
Oh, he dropped the ball on that again, didn't he? Send your hate mail to techshow@thelinuxlink.net. Care of Link Fezzetta. Hate mail. I miss Link. It's not the same without him.
he can't defend himself here.
Aye.
It's no fun bashing him if he can't defend himself.
That's right. What else happened this week? Got some email from some of the other shows that we've mentioned in the past couple of weeks, and thanking us for mentioning them. And,
you did?
Yeah. Linux Basement, I believe, was one.
I heard him mention us in his podcast.
I know we talked about the Linux Outlaws. They have thanked us. God, why can't I find any of the shows? But
Going Linux,
good show. There's a lot of good shows out there that have recently come to our attention. But good stuff. And I had the HIV today, so cut me some slack there, Pat.
I'm not going to jump all over because you're sick. Thinking it sounds like the sickness Nazi or something.
You know what, Alan, you had asked about whether I had tried using the what is the feature in Audacity called? Truncate Silence, I believe it is.
Truncate Silence, yeah.
I did try it on some of the recordings I did earlier. It seems to work okay. I may try it on the tech show. I'm always kind of kind of reluctant to try or to use something that tool, because I know I used something similar to it a little while ago, and it really messed up the audio.
Well, I think the one thing you got to be careful about, like I said, I did that one, and cut like 10 minutes of silence out, but that was like by default, it's super aggressive on it. It looks for like 2 millisecond gaps to chop up on. I really think you got to, like, put that up to, like, you know, maybe, you know, half a second at least on it, because I listened to it, and the interview didn't sound too bad on it, but when we were talking, you know, the three of us were talking, you could tell it was like chopping us a little bit too much there. So you may, like I said, you may want to, if you're going to try it, do it with a little less of aggressive silence, whatever you want to call it. I don't have it up right now.
You know, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah, it's set for like 200 milliseconds, I think.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. My concern about that is if for some reason it sometimes, you know, the audio of like the guest or something might end up being a little soft, but probably not. I'll give it a whirl. We'll do it on this show.
Yeah, there is a threshold that you can set for it. You know, like how many dBs down, you know, so it ignores the noise, like, you know, when the turbo fan was coming up and, you know, up and down and in the silence. So it was ignoring the turbo fan. And that was a good thing. I pulled the AUG that we had for it, and you just have to convert it to, you know, mono track and then run it.
Well, I don't record it in stereo, so.
Oh, I know, but I do over here, so.
Maybe that's why it's crashing. You're running out of disk space.
Not according to this, I got 56 gigs on here, so. Should be enough for one show.
Damn.
Actually, I'm trying to cat together all those AU files. See what happens. A mess. Probably. I don't really care.
You know what? I hate when Audacity...
Hopefully we don't crash.
I hate it when Audacity teases you and says, would you like to recover? And it never does.
Mine didn't give the option. It restarted. When I restarted, it said there were files in the temp directory that were not deleted. And it wanted to know if I wanted to delete them. And I said no, so... We'll see what happens. In the meantime, I'll just restart it and maybe it'll record. Maybe it won't. There's a missing 5 minutes or so here.
You know who hasn't put out a show in a while? That lazy Jeremy Garcia. We haven't had
a he's a busy guy, man.
I don't care.
He's gone to a lot of conferences, you know, and busy with his job.
I don't care. No excuse.
He's the conference maven, that guy. He goes to, like, every conference.
Dun, dun, dun. I don't even think there was... Was there a release of Twit this week?
I don't know. I don't listen to that.
You don't listen to Mac Break? Or what is it? Is it Mac Break Weekly?
I listened to that once, man, and I my head nearly exploded. Actually, let me take that back. I did listen to a recent episode of Twit. Somebody at work mentioned that Cory Doctorow was on there.
Yes.
And I listened to that episode, and that was actually a good episode. We should get him back on. Cory Doctorow is great, man.
I like listening to him. I do listen to Twit, and that's only because it's something I listen to in the background at work.
Yeah, it's good for that. I listen to it on the way in. It's one of the podcasts I listen to.
I don't like to listen to the Linux podcasts at work because I want to give them more attention than what I actually, you know, have at work to give. But I listen to all of them in the car because they're in my mind. They're the important shows. But that's the way it goes. It's been an awful lot of Apple and Windows love on Twit these days.
Ugh.
Never any Linux love.
No thanks, man. They can keep those shows. No offense to Leo. Leo's a nice guy and everything, man, but those shows aren't my cup of tea. No thanks. I don't care about the iPhone. You know? I don't care about Vista. I don't care about SpinRite. I don't care about any of that stuff.
He's still against all this stuff, you know?
Security now is the worst, man. Like, the first 15 minutes of the show is a freaking commercial for that stupid SpinRite product he's always plugging.
Well, you just have to, like, bypass the first 15 minutes.
Nah, I don't bother anymore.
There's some interesting stuff on
that just
show.
Bypasses the whole show.
I don't listen to any of those shows anymore. The last show I listened to was that Cory Doctorow on Twit. And I hadn't listened to the Twit in ages. I can't remember the last time I listened to that show. The only reason I listened to it is because Cory was on there. And what was great was Cory went on there, and he totally jumped on Leo for the sponsor for implementing DRM. It was one of those audio books.
Yeah,
companies.
Crap. What's the name of that company? I know what you're talking about now. Because I looked at
it.
Was it oh, man. What is that company?
Hold on, I'll tell you in a second.
Sponsored
by... They have all DRM all over them.
I think it's one of the only audiobooks stores.
there's
a couple.
It's like it's not Audacity. It's not Audacious. It's and you know what? I'm going to think of it right
Audible.
As Pat starts Audible. Yeah. There you go.
Yeah, thanks, Mad Dog.
Yeah, there's a couple of Audible's one. Patio Books is another company. But I think Audible was the one that was a sponsor, and they implement DRM. And Cory just, like, jumped all over him.
Yeah, well, what are you going to do? I went to Project Gutenberg, and I downloaded book one of Paradise Lost, and I pumped that through, what text-to-speech engine was I using? I think it's Festival, but it uses, I was using the KDE application to do it. K-Speech or something like that. And it worked fairly well. It worked really well, actually. When I chose the right voice that I liked, it worked very well. But then as it was going through, I kind of lost interest in it. Because, I don't know, you could listen to Paradise Lost. But when you read it, you actually get the full impact. Because he uses a lot of heavy-duty jackhammer words in there. Did you ever read Paradise Lost?
No.
It's a good read. It's not an easy, quick read, but it's good. Pat, what was the song that I was supposed to play?
Last week?
Yeah.
I just copied it back up. It's Dave Henderson, Wired for Loud.
Oh, okay.
It's in the music folder on the server.
Let me pull that over here. Get that queued up to go. Where is it?
It's on the server. It's up there.
No, I know it is, but why am I not seeing it?
I don't know.
It's there.
Doesn't like you, Dan.
I saw on the forum, though, that Everex, the company that released that low-end PC at Walmart, the $200 PC, they're both coming out with a low-end laptop that'll compete with the EPC from Asus.
Yeah, what do you think of that?
I think it will succeed if they price it less than the Asus. When you're at a low-end machine like that, there's a big difference between, say, $250 and $400. And it's going to run that GOS, though, which it should be good.
Yeah, it looks kind of interesting. $499. See, I don't know. I get torn because I look at that $499. You spend another $100, you can get a full-fledged laptop.
That's true. You're right.
I don't know.
somebody from the Lug picked up the Asus one, and he wasn't feeling well, so he didn't come to the meeting, but he said he's going to bring it to the next meeting, so got to check that out. It's gotten good reviews. I mean, you look around, people said positive things about it.
I'll have to find somebody who has one and check it out for myself.
Have you had a chance to go to the Lug meetings down there, Dan?
I've been to one. I haven't had a chance. You see, they're really close to where I work, but the problem is I got to hang around till about 7:30, and then I have like a 45-minute drive home after that. And, you know, usually by then I just want to get home and spend time with my family. It's tough, but I really, you know, the Lug down here is pretty cool, but it's hard. I want to go back to another meeting.
Create another one down there by you.
Then I have to drive 45 minutes to get to it. And although it would be closer to where I live. But.
That's pretty far away, man.
Yeah, it can be. But that's the closest Lug. It's like a 10-minute drive from where I work now, if that.
Well, that song is pretty long, so if you want to fire it up, man, go ahead.
All right, let me clear out this here, get it ready to go.
It's kind of a long song. It's an instrumental. It's pretty good, though.
So he can sing along to it.
Yeah, this is from Podsafe Music, Dave Henderson. We've played his stuff in the past. It's kind of like bluesy, Allman Brothers kind of, and some other influences like Eric Johnson kind of. Blues rock kind of thing. It's pretty good.
All right.
Next week, we've got Rob Savoy, who is the Ganache Project developer, and he's also an alternate energy advocate. He's going to talk to us about, besides Ganache, about different things to do with saving money with energy consumption, which should be an interesting conversation, I think. I'd like to save some money on my energy costs.
True, true, cool. True. All right. If that's it, go ahead.
Who doesn't want to live off the grid, you know? Recycling toilet paper.
Yeah. How do you recycle that?
I don't know. I'll have to ask him.
All right.
Something I don't want to think about, actually.
Here's Wired for Loud. By David Henderson. We'll see you all next week. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Good night, everybody.
Let us know how you like the audio quality of this show. Not so much as the interview, because the cell phone was a little scratchy on his end, but whether the hum was as annoying as it's been in the past. So give us a listen to it. And yeah, we'll talk to you next
Thanks,
week.
Thanks, Al.
You're welcome.
Have a happy
Good night.
Good night. Good night, everyone. Silence.
You know what? I'm going to start that over. I don't know why my volume was down so low. That didn't make any sense.
So we can paint anything we want?
Anything at all.
How about if I paint your fine ass? Mm, yeah, with my tongue brush.
Shut up. Just shut up. It's over.
It's over.